Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Dozeman. It's often said that the time in our lives can often pass without us noticing. Old age can come before we realize it, and it brings with it new elements to our own daily lives that we couldn't have anticipated before. Observed from a distance, and growing old can seem like a universal experience. But observed up close, it becomes clear that the different ways people age are as varied and unique as the people themselves. And these differences can come from within and without. Whether you get to live out your twilight years in a comfortable retirement home in the country or an understaffed inner city hospital, these experiences will be profoundly different and likely had different paths that led to them. Viewed in this way, aging is seen not as some eternal experience that is the same for all people, but as a fundamental part of our politics and economic dynamics, for better and for worse. The COVID crisis of the last year has brought to light how vulnerable our elderly are, how understaffed our care facilities are, and how much needs to change to provide lives of safety, comfort, and dignity to our elders. But in many ways, all this crisis has done is exacerbated certain tensions and antagonisms that were already there, barely concealed by the relentless optimism of neoliberal technocrats. Changing these systems will mean rethinking the aging process and connecting it with broader questions traditionally raised by the fields of critical theory and radical critiques of political economy. Diving right into this project are my guests today, Carol Estes and Nicholas DiCarlo, here to discuss their recent publication, Aging A to Z, Concepts Towards Emancipatory Gerontology, from Routledge in 2019. Styled as a sort of dictionary, the book has entries for a number of terms you would expect a book like this to have. Ableism, home care, and retirement all make appearances. Readers will be surprised, however, by the number of entries that also make appearances. Climate change, colonialism, epistemology, Leninist strategy, and praxis all make appearances as well. This book, then, is incredibly broad in scope and attempts to force readers to realize the ways in which aging is affected that go beyond one's immediate concern, bringing a new layer of understanding to the phrase, the personal is political. Speaking as someone who has spent the entirety of the COVID crisis working in elderly care, this book was a joyful revelation to flip through and should be considered critical reading by anyone impacted by aging. Carol Estes has a long and distinguished career in both academia and activism. She is Professor Emerita of Sociology at the University of California, San Francisco. It was there that she founded the Institute for Health and Aging. She has written numerous books and articles on the politics of aging, including the co-authored The Long-Term Care Crisis, which was a 1994 most important book for Choice magazine. She is also the recipient of numerous academic honors and is the former president of the Gerontological Society of America, the American Society on Aging, and the Association for Gerontology in Higher Education. Nicholas DiCarlo writes about aging and social policy at the Institute for Health and Aging at the University of California, San Francisco. They have a Master's of Social Work and a private psychotherapy practice in Oakland. And Nick DiCarlo, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks for having us, Stephen. Oh, and I go by Nicholas.
Oh, Nicholas, thank you. All right. So to kick things off, I was wondering if you two could introduce yourselves and tell us a bit about your background and how some of that might have informed this book you have here.
I am very fortunate to have come of age intellectually in the middle of the crises of the Vietnam War protests, feminist protests, the whole civil rights issues, and voter issues, going to Columbia, South Carolina, and being terrified by voter registration there. It's been wonderful, however, that my experience in those early social movements completely challenged me as a Southern girl who learned to say nothing, be silent, and obedient. And I found my revolutionary self peeking out as I was marching around federal buildings. My dad was a federal judge, and he certainly did not know that I was doing that. But I was becoming enraged at Brandeis University, where I was working as a research assistant after my master's degree. And it really took me on a policy wonk trip that I've been on with policy activism for decades since then. The foundation, really the foundation of my learning and developing political economy in my first book, was The Aging Enterprise, which was a critical examination of old age policy and services. And I bumped into Nicholas along the way, thank goodness, for our intergenerational work together.
I was really lucky to meet Carol when I finished my MSW in New York. I moved out to the Bay, and a colleague put us in touch. I grew up in West Virginia and went to New York for my undergrad at Vassar, studied media studies and film, was very interested in representation and oppression, specifically about fat oppression. And my MSW wasn't specifically focused on aging. I was more interested in working with refugees and diverse populations across the globe. But a mentor put me in touch with Carol, and we got started on a chapter that was talking about the history of, I think it was how critical gerontology came of age, sort of post-World War II. And it was an infusion of the anti-fascist Jewish social workers who were getting into the field, and also coinciding with the burgeoning social civil rights movement. So that was sort of our introduction to each other. And then we got started on A to Z pretty shortly after.
Yeah, so that kind of leads right into talking about... go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, I neglected I graduated from Stanford. I have a master's from Southern Methodist University and a doctorate from University of California, San Diego.
Yeah, excellent. So I want to turn to the book itself. So when I first started looking through this book, one thing that kind of threw me off at first was how broad it is in scope. It goes well beyond just talking about terms I would have immediately thought of when I thought about like critically thinking about old age and aging. You cover things like media and political economy, you know, the nature of history, lots of terms that I wouldn't initially think needed to be in this book. So I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about the goal of the book and the reason for such a broad approach, such a broad scope. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yes. The experience of my writing The Aging Enterprise, which was a critical study of the Older Americans Act and aging services, was an eye-opener, and the medical industrial complex and really the abjection of older people the stigmatization, the ageism, and all of those issues arose. And I spoke of the empowerment imperative for the field of aging and for practitioners in that era. And it was very much a commitment to going beyond the present into the kind of crazy worlds we were finding ourselves in. And the book started when Hillary Clinton was supposed to become president, and it rode through much of the Trump administration and the uprooting of everything that we took as reality, or that was taken as reality by and large. And it was something that called out to us to require wild excursions into new concepts and new issues and old issues that had been festering but not dealt with in terms of inequality, race, class, gender. And those were the foundational pieces that we started with. So Nicholas, why don't you take it from here for...
Yeah, I think the 2016 election was definitely part of us taking it big. That's one thing that Carol's really shared with me, C. Wright Mills' concept of going big. And one thing that we really wanted to do is to show that age isn't just a study of old age. Gerontology is looking at all of us as we age and the intergenerational bonds that exist. There's so much of the neoliberal agenda that dehistoricizes social movements and cuts people off from their histories. And I really see this kind of broad depth of scope as helping combat some of that ahistoricity.
Yeah, so this book is kind of taking what kind of fits into the broad umbrella of what we often call critical theory. So I'm wondering if you could talk a bit in more detail about what you see as the relationship between critical theory and thinking critically about aging. And more broadly, we could ask, you know, questions about like political economy and the relationship to aging and vice versa. How does aging kind of fit in this field, in your view?
Critical theory is devoted to attacking oppression and objectification and the things that bring down humanity and all living things, including the environment and air, water, fire, everything. Although it has now become, and we are working toward the emancipatory phase, which is the concern with respect and justice and equality and race, class, ethnicity, genders, anew in the current phase that we find. And emancipatory work has basically the idea that there is no value-neutral knowledge, and that power relations inform knowledge, and our language is power and power constructions of reality. And research is basically a political activity, and social oppressions are not natural or fixed. So social change resistance movements, social movements are part of the discourse, and the field is being built as we speak.
And I would add that this was especially, aging study was ready for it. There was so defined by medicalization and functionalism, and these ageist ideas about older adulthood being a state of being diminished, losing opportunity, and sort of accepting the natural consequences of growing into irrelevance. So there were many opportunities within gerontology to talk about power relations and to bring in critical concepts.
Yeah, jumping right off of that, one thing that's often associated with growing older as various forms of decline. They can be physical, they can be cognitive, they can be emotional, and often those can kind of feed into one another in various ways. So I'm wondering if you could kind of talk about some of those different paths people's lives can take and how critical theory can help us think more critically about these changes people go through as they grow older.
Ageism and abjection are examples of concepts which basically stigmatize the elderly, pigeonhole the whole, make all elders seem worthless, useless, as Maggie Kuhn, who co-founded the Gray Panthers, used to say, useless, toothless, mindless, infants, infantilization of elders, which is basically a form of learned helplessness that is pervade across society. And the whole jokester stuff about aging we see every day. And this kind of treatment is very influential on how the elderly view themselves. And we know from research that the lack of confidence in one's ability and treatment of being one as infantile, talked about in front of them, demeaned, not talked with at all, is very disabling and enabling of further loss of cognition and capabilities and empowerment.
I'd add that we also see that manifest with social policy, that a lot of the fight is already lost to these defeatist attitudes, that Social Security can't exist, that resources are too scarce. And that sort of fits right alongside with the functionalist framework of aging as a process of decline. Why would you give people who can't contribute to these really narrow definitions of work value and labor any of the benefits of society? I think this really speaks to sort of the fascist undergirdings of our labor ideology.
Yeah, I want to jump right off that to another thing I wanted to ask, which was the value of non-productive life. How do you see fields like critical theory helping us think about life, particularly in old age, when it's maybe not as economically productive, but obviously we want to say still has value? How do we kind of challenge some of that stigma and think more critically about the value of life when it's, you know, maybe no longer producing in the traditional sense we think about it, but we want to say is still valuable? Can you speak to that a bit?
The value of labor is also determined by our society's market logics and productivity, the ideological commitment to amassing wealth and income as what is productive. And there are so many, it's like an erasure of the entire history of generations that have contributed and built, including the ones present and coming along, building our society and the advances that we have, being denied, invisibilized, rendered irrelevant or non-existent. And it's very much what is so denigrating about the attacks on Social Security and Medicare is not earned. When in fact, we've all paid into those programs of social insurance and committed to the economies that we have, terrible as they are right at this moment. But the fact is that our entire society and advancement, as well as our stigmata on race and on patriarchy and on genders is something that is very much invoked in our policy on aging. And I'm very taken with the concept of policy violence. And this book is a lot about policy violence, which speaks to how policy puts down, breaks down, ignores, destroys communities and peoples.
I think one aspect of ageism too is this idea that you're participating in your own, an attack against a future self. When we're not valuing older adults as people who are holding valuable knowledge or holding a function for our mental well-being, I see that people who have no experience with caregiving or have not had any exposure to older adults are terrified of aging. And that leads to the kind of hopelessness and nihilism where people are more quick to accept the destruction of the commons and the political crises of the day. I think elders are really an important part of resisting the political domination.
Yeah. One thing I want to ask is the question of agency. So obviously in their personal lives, as people get older, they will struggle to kind of be able to take care of themselves and manage all their affairs. But I think there's also a question of larger political forms of agency, the ways people can organize themselves, have policy directed in a way that's favorable or at the very least not harmful towards them and their interests. And I suspect that, you know, this is going to, there's going to be a lot of questions as COVID clears up where we're going to need to kind of rethink a lot of these things. But I'm wondering if you can talk about agency and its relationship to old age and vice versa. How do you see agency being impacted by one's age?
Well, agency is absolutely critical. It is the possibility of social change, and agency operates on so many levels. So it's includes, but is well beyond the individual, and that's what social movements and the really wonderful resistance movements that have been generated in this last saga of our policy under the current administration, not the current administration, the prior administration, and the extent to which agency is now something within grasp again, as it was in earlier times when I was marching around federal buildings and boycotting and going to do voter registration. It's as though we've gone back in time while we've zoomed forward in time at the same thing. And the structural and systemic roots of things are becoming of our way of life and how people are shut out and cut out and have very little capacity for participating in society fully and therefore agency, but also how our institutions, all of our institutions of the state, how we've had a president, now a past president, who has shown us the cruelty and the tools and the uses of the state in horrific ways. And they have really reached out to so many millions of us to join together and understand that we can and must make a difference. We must make the change that we seek.
I would say that especially for old age, we can't really talk about agency without also thinking about ableism, that so much of what's written in the framework of what we imagine someone capable of being doing or giving them opportunities to do or accommodations to do is such a critical component of who has that opportunity to step up and be in the room and use their voice. And one aspect of the last 4 years I've been particularly interested in is when people are deluded about their capacity to act and have a false sense of safety and belonging. One term that we introduced in A to Z was delirium. And this was right on the heels of the Trump election. I think we were working on it before, trying to get away from a medicalized understanding and thinking about it more as a sort of social and psychic breakdown. And I had gotten into Derrida's conception of delirium as a framework to understand German Jews who were remaining in Nazi Germany and kept insisting that it was safe. They felt that they had the agency to remain and to thrive. And we've seen, especially in these last 4 years, this delirium about Make America Great has been so destructive for people thinking that this is their pathway to have an opportunity to act. Not sure if I have a cherry to put on top of that.
Yeah, no, we can move along. Another thing I want to bring up is thinking about aging as something that everyone experiences, but people across different places along the spectrum of gender, sexuality, class, and other forms of identity will invariably kind of complicate how everyone experiences that in different ways. So it's simultaneously a very universal experience, but also I'm wondering if you could kind of talk a bit about how different people will experience it in very different ways based on their place in society.
Well, a major piece of work in the field has been developing the theory of cumulative advantage and disadvantage. And the findings, instead of homogenization, that there is increased disadvantage if one is disadvantaged and increased advantage if one is advantaged. And Dale Danifer and a number of other scholars have been on the forefront of this very important work, which has identified that disadvantage is something an advantage. They're both experienced across the life course, and people, of course, have advantages and disadvantages, but they accumulate across time. And it used to be that aging theory was everybody became more equal with age. Now that's completely disputed with research and is very much part of the understanding that whatever happens, even as early if you get into the gene environment work with telomeres, even as early as being in the womb, injury and abuse and poverty and lack of education can be a harm that is accentuated across the generations of time that one in which one lives, assuming that they have a cumulative effect over time. And this is a major period piece of work that points to where does resilience and where does all sorts of opportunity for improvements be in some predicaments, because as if we're whatever our mapping is of advantage and disadvantage, that we're going to get more and more of the advantage if we're advantaged, and we're going to get more and more of disadvantage if we're disadvantaged. And this obviously has huge implications for race and class and genders and all of the opportunities that we could have, which is just played right into the whole COVID thing with the inequalities that are evident in every kind of way with chronic illnesses and actually the decline in life expectancy, massive decline in life expectancy in 2020 by 5 years, a huge for African Americans, but also decline in life expectancy, which is mushroomed in terms of amount for Latino and Latina peoples. So it's a very prolific and important set of work that is going on. And we were also in our A to Z work, we're taking it further to not only is it happening a cumulative advantage and disadvantage across individual life cycles, and it is happening in terms of exploitation and labor disadvantage and income, wealth inequality. All of these things have mushroomed at huge levels. So the individual and the society and the interaction is incredibly important as well.
One way that we see inequality stratified is also through the social policy that either values or doesn't value caregiving work, and how many people have to exit the workforce or work reduced hours to provide care for their networks. And if you don't have wealth, then that work definitely isn't paid, and those are years that you're not earning for your Social Security contributions. So we see it baked into social policy that these trends of cumulative disadvantage and advantage are really structurally supported.
And that's part of the policy violence.
And as Carol was saying, this is also, you know, sets up the conditions for exploitation. When people live with precarity, when they're vulnerable, when they can't say no to a job or a political reality because they're fighting day to day to survive, that's a great form of social control.
Yeah. One thing I want to ask about is rethinking aging as a culmination of a particular sort of lifetime, thinking about aging as a product of the job you had, the sorts of experiences you had throughout your life, and how that will affect how you experience your final years. I think oftentimes we think of aging as something that will happen eventually and not something that is always happening and always kind of accumulating in various ways. And I think your background in kind of critical theory and critical sociology is perfectly addressed to kind of help us rethink aging in this way. So can you speak to that way of rethinking aging that I think is kind of implicit throughout some of the passages in your book?
A lot of talk about aging is about aging across the life course. And we are aging from the moment of conception to actually until death. And this is a process that has inputs along the way, but it definitely what happens to children and this gene environment work and the work on telomeres is an example. Liz Blackburn, the Nobel Prize winner on this work, how important it is, the telomeres, which actually show the shortness or length of strands of DNA, and how these may be improved, actually. And this is part of the wonderful potentiality of joining society, cells in society, although there are plenty of pitfalls to getting too biomedical and too much scientization without the proper attention to the social factors that are involved.
One of the entries in A to Z is retirement. And we were looking at some of the frameworks for how retirement's framed socially. In Britain, it's the term is redundancy. The idea is that you're no longer needed, so there's someone younger that needs to come in and you're taking up a valuable opportunity. So I think that's one of the frameworks for our aging experience, kind of baked into the job as the identity. And one thing that I really appreciated in this project was getting to learn more about the history, that it wasn't until 1986 through an amendment to the Age Discrimination and Employment Act that states were penalized for discriminating against those under 61.
Yeah, another thing I want to ask about is social life in old age. So obviously with the pandemic, this has, I think, become like abundantly clear in a new way with old people kind of being forced to really isolate much more intensely than usual. But I think in a way it's kind of exacerbating a problem that was already there, that as you grow older, it can be harder to kind of maintain connections. It's harder to get out of your house, harder to kind of spend time and energy connecting with people. It's harder to get to a place where people usually meet, like a restaurant or a coffee shop. So I'm wondering if you can talk about social life in old age and how it connects to a number of the concepts we've been developing. What are the kind of larger structures that kind of not only push people to isolate, but kind of force them to in a certain way?
Well, our society is in many ways segregated segregated in all sorts of dimensions. But one of them is you think about residential living and nursing homes and its opposition in aging in place and aging in community and the new perspectives on aging in community and other options. But there's no question that the isolation that one feels is likely to be exacerbated. But also it's an opportunity for figuring out how to be more connected. But it really means needing more opportunities within one's family structure or community structure or residential structure, insofar as that self-isolation is really down to life and death calls for what we must do.
And the age segregation goes beyond just where older adults live, but also where they're encouraged to congregate. Maggie Kuhn of the Panthers, the Gray Panthers, called senior centers playpens for the elderly. Why should older adults only be given this opportunity to congregate with each other? Why is it not baked in or available for the rest of the community to engage? And I think sort of where we are now in our analysis is also thinking about how gentrification aids and abets this process of segregating older adults out of communities. Where can they afford to live? What are the resources that they can access? And how are people forced into retirement homes or skilled nursing facilities, because those are the only places they can get their basic needs met?
Which speaks to a lack of
Elena Porta Colonna.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to add that a researcher that we work with, Elena Porta Colonna, has done some really excellent research about isolation in old age and what older adults want, how living alone is often what someone wants, but that doesn't mean that they want a life of isolation. And they're forced to either live with other people out of necessity, but that also doesn't mean that they get to really leave their houses or apartments and be in the community. Some of these communities older adults live in are dangerous and unsafe for them to be out and about.
So also the lack of long-term care policy. Yes. The policy is that women will do the work and they will do it at great sacrifice and they will do it until they drop, basically. And it's endless, especially. And COVID, and now with having children and grandchildren and having to pick up the pace of work to the point that it's completely untenable for women. And of course, women are dropping out of the labor force like crazy. And in fact, the term she session is a concept that is now being bandied about. But also the basic fact that there's, we talk about the 0 years in Social Security. There's no credit for any time spent in caregiving of elders or spouses or anyone. And we've been talking about this for at least 20 years, maybe 30. And in fact, I was part of a project that wrote about breaking the glass ceiling in Social Security, which was identifying these issues that are glass ceilings that are on top of the whole pre-existing situation that women find themselves as the childbearers and caregivers.
Yeah, another term that comes up in a couple different forms is that of the generation. And I want to ask about intergenerational understanding, kind of helping the young understand the elderly and vice versa. And I want to ask, because I think obviously it's nice to have young and old sit down together and chat, but I think that intergenerational understanding is often impeded not just by failing to sit down and talk with one another, but by certain larger structures that kind of guide and define our experience and make it hard for us to hear and understand each other. And I think you can just look at how politicians will often try and cater to young or old in different ways. There's different interests at stake and different ways of understanding our experiences at play. So I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about how generations might understand themselves, each other, and our current moment, and how that kind of can lead to certain misunderstandings.
I think segregated policies that segregate and categorize different groups for housing or transportation or other things contribute to this. But the intergenerational work is absolutely essential because we are all in this together. It's a basic understanding of a much larger social community and society that where we pick up the pieces and work toward a larger good. And our market logic takeover of the way we think in American society and in capitalist society has really quashed the notions of community and social and our responsibility to the whole. And this is an intergenerational bond that is absolutely essential. And Maggie Kuhn, as Nicholas mentioned, was pivotal in creating that understanding that youth and age are in it together. And there's discrimination against youth too, as and against baby boomers now as coming online, having benefits that they have earned or want to have. And this is the bonding issue is very important. Nicholas?
One thing that came up for me when I was listening was this idea of being together in space. And Carol told me this wonderful story about how Maggie Kuhn was in the anti-war protest, was marching with younger protesters because there was this idea that older adults who were flanking them would be able to repel some of the police violence, that the brutality would have some respect for older adults. But we've seen now that that's not true. We saw Martin Cugino in Buffalo get struck down with a head wound. And I think if we're really going to talk about older adults and younger adults being able to come together, we also have to think about the right to protest and how that's very uncertain in this current state where police terror is normalized.
Yeah, I think that connects really well to what Carol was saying was about policy violence. I thought also of the representative from Texas saying, you know, we need to just kind of sacrifice old people for the sake of the market. Just that kind of political brutality that comes down so hard on old people. And you know, jumping kind of similarly off that, I want to talk about systems for making aging more comfortable. So obviously, as we've been talking about at a couple places, as one grows older, it can be harder to just maintain a basic level of comfort and dignity. And we do have some systems in place like nursing homes and other forms of elderly care, although these often are kind of understaffed, overworked places, and they are very prohibitively expensive for a lot of people, especially as one's care needs go up. So can you talk a bit about the systems we do have in place, but kind of the limitations of those systems and how we might need to kind of rethink about them a little more critically, and what sort of systems we might want to have in place to help aid dignified old age?
I think COVID has provided a mirror of issues around residential location and dignity and respect for elders and their basic predicament, which the whole nursing home industry has been an outrage for many activists and supporters of a life of dignity and quality. And the commercialization and hiding of the problems with nursing homes. I think about a colleague of ours, Charlene Harrington, who has done so much in terms of the empirical work on nursing staffing and quality measures, and has really a national calling on this issue that we've just seen it even yesterday with Governor Cuomo in New York, and the designation of whether people died from COVID in the hospital or the nursing home. These are pressures that have camouflaged what's really going on in our society. Like many others, these are systemic and structural pressures for profits in nursing homes and conglomerations of those, and the deprivation of basic human care and rights. So this is I think COVID-19 has really heightened the awareness of this, but there has been just a seduction in trying to generalize it without really getting specific about the sites and locations and what are the root causes and more structural profit-making commodification of the whole field is really needs to be highlighted now. And we saw in California where the first run about who should get vaccines was a triage that excluded the elderly, that they should not get it. And fortunately, there was a master plan on aging in California that was being developed that was brought into play and provided an opportunity for rising up of those people working on that to really reverse that policy. So then we saw the massive reversal of going to how the elderly had some preference. So it's a very confounding, conflicting space.
I think if we really want to make aging more comfortable too, we have to boost and expand Social Security. It's such a lifeblood. And Carol, correct me if I'm wrong on this, it used to be considered one of the legs to a three-legged stool. And what's the, what is it called now?
The three-legged stool? Our Social Security is now social insecurity. At least that's been the basic mantra that privatizers of Social Security, which would send trillions into the stock market, and we know how vulnerable that would be. But the whole point of the improvement of Social Security, I think it is now going to be on the table in the current environment and administration, the changeover, that there are hundreds of sponsors of Social Security improvement bills. And it absolutely should not be the case that people who are receiving Social Security are below poverty. And this is a case for many people. Social Security is the essential income, is more than 60 for more than 60% of the people. It's a very high proportion, and for 20%, it's 90% of their income, and their income is at or below poverty. And this is something that has been a piece of my work for at least four decades. We've been fighting the privatizers of Social Security who've basically wanted to take it over. And we've watched the privatization of Medicare through managed care organizations and bits and pieces, where the uniform benefits are now disaggregated based on ability to buy different parts and augmentations of Medicare. So both of these programs are the bedrock. They are really the bedrock of our society and dignity and respect for all people, because a third of Social Security goes to the disabled and orphan children and children of disabled persons.
And when Social Security was thought to be one of the stool legs to the three-legged stool, that was assuming that pensions were a thing and in place. Teresa Ghilarducci from the New School writes about how pension plans have completely evaporated. And what remains in place is largely privatized and has exorbitant costs for maintaining. So people spend down whatever was in their pension plan before they're able to get it. And now we have, I think the third leg of the stool was supposed to be private savings. But how is that possible when you have so many older adults who are living in poverty? We have 2/3, I think it is, of older adults who live with food insecurity. The stool is pretty wobbly.
I also wanted to ask, kind of along similar lines, about the labor that goes into sustaining one's life. We've been kind of talking about this at a couple points, but one thing that old age really kind of brings to the fore is how much work goes into just living one's day-to-day life, cooking one's food, dressing oneself, going to the bathroom, getting in and out of bed. And oftentimes, as one gets older, one needs to depend on others for just that very basic sort of labor of self-maintenance and self-care. So we've talked about this, about kind of nursing homes and broader social systems that can sometimes make that happen. But I'm wondering if you can talk a bit more about just that very basic idea of labor that goes into keeping one's life going, and in very much non-productive labor, labor that's just about maintenance.
Well, just even the thought that it's called non-productive labor, these concepts of what's productive and what's non-productive need critical analysis and are part of very much what our work has been about, calling these things out. Nevertheless, home care, in-home care, unskilled care. I mean, our policies have not supported long-term care or what are unskilled care. I'm talking about Medicare policy, and only for short periods of time, location in nursing homes where one might, but only until they don't need skilled care. So it's been a set of a set of zeros in terms of the ability to receive this kind of care, unless it comes from an underpaid or a non-paid workers who are primarily women who are in the family and the home. But if one doesn't have that, then they're really, the policy supports for home and community-based services get a lot of rhetoric, and we all know that aging in place, how important it is, but this work is all, is yet to be done to build the base. Now, certain states like Washington and Oregon have done a major job in building home and community-based care initiatives, but they've mainly been demonstrations funded at the state level or built off of Medicaid waivers, which is obviously health care for the indigent and disabled, blind and disabled. It's a major piece of work that I hope our current new administration will attack positively.
And having this divide between productive labor and non-productive labor, I think speaks to me about how abject we find dependency and weakness. This is where having an understanding of the ideology of fascism, I think, is really handy for us. We can look at how many billions of dollars are poured into the anti-aging industry, especially here in Silicon Valley. We have Peter Thiel and Jeff Bezos, you know, turning into venture capitalists to look at gene manipulation, 3D printed organs, infusions of enzymes to prevent senescence. You have these biologists that are injecting growth hormone into their legs and hurting themselves lifting refrigerators. This is how far we go to avoid having to ask the question of what goes into the day-to-day life of someone who's aging and losing ability or capacity to complete these things.
Yeah. Another thing I want to ask about is stereotypes, both positive and negative, and their effects on how we think about and design policy and systems around aging and old age. So obviously there's negative stereotypes about kind of increasing uselessness and disability. There's positive ones about wisdom and kind of having that accumulative knowledge of that one gains over a lifetime. But I'm wondering if you can talk about how you see stereotypes informing policy and social systems and how we design them, you know, for better and worse. How are they maybe possibly misleading or misguiding us in how we try and take care of the elderly?
There's no question that public policy has segregated elders and it's complicated because technically it's seen as trying to help them, but helping them insofar as one doesn't have access to them unless one is absolutely, completely depleted financially or emotionally or both and physically is a real problem. Also, we know from interactionist theory, symbolic interactionism, now I'm calling on, is how important it is, how people look at us. We think about ourselves and reflect back on that. And we learn messages from others. We take messages from others as cues that we're worthless or don't qualify for certain things, don't even know about them. And the whole digital dysphoria, that's what I call it. My digital dysphoria is absolutely so difficult as, and I'm not alone. I can't be alone in this. And we're just we have these barriers, these new barriers that are now you have to be able to have a phone, a cell phone, or this or that, the capabilities of getting online, of being able to persist online to get any benefits, or if you have anybody helping you, caregivers, they're having to do that or just doing without, basically.
And these stereotypes about old age, these stereotypes about old age, they also sort of frame it as natural and expected that older adults can't or won't belong or fit into the framework. It goes into the idea of being undeserving. one thing that I really loved in the second or third year of our collaboration, we founded a sort of imaginary institute called the Crone Institute, the Center for Respecting Our Noetic Equality. And we were interested in resuscitating the archetype of the crone as a site of power. Witches and older women have been hunted down and ignored, mocked, made the butt of jokes.
Burn at the stake. Yes. Well, the term, the witch hunt, this is the word that's probably been used more in the last 4 years than any other term, or certainly among repeated terms. And that's something I want to explore and invite us to explore. What is this notion of the witch hunt and how it ties into actually hunting humanity down, hunting positivity and attempted public policy that addresses social needs and human beings and our environment in positive respects, rather than destroying families, taking children, separating them, and more. And just even raising voice about that has been called a witch hunt, and that we're all nuts to even think that these are something to be concerned about repeatedly.
And the stereotypes of older adults as that either infantilize them as sweet things with no fangs, or grouchy people that aren't tied into any sort of shared reality. These take people out of their running, take their voices out. And we see it in the social policy with Medicare. What isn't covered? We have vision, dental. What's the third one? Teeth, no, ears. Yes, ears, teeth, hearing. It's like the Little Red Riding Hood story. These are the things that we don't want older adults to have, because the idea that they could advocate for themselves or actually be wolves is so forbidden, that we'd have a whole population of people that would have this totally different political power and involvement in society. And I don't think this country wants that. The powers that be are making too much money off of people accepting their deaths and decline without resisting.
Yeah, for a final question I have, the subtitle of the book is Concepts Toward Emancipatory Gerontology. And one thing I want to ask, broadly speaking, what is maybe a way of framing this? What is an understanding of aging you think would need to be in place, or an understanding of old age you think would need to be in place to kind of kickstart broader political changes needed to kind of help people live lives throughout even their twilight years, lives of comfort and dignity? How do we need to rethink what it means to age and to grow old?
Well, I'll cut in that we certainly need a media watch. That was something that existed in the 70s and 80s with the Grey Panthers. But there's so much on TV that I see and in the news that just fits right into these aging stereotypes. And there's no one holding them accountable, and there's no public outrage. And yeah, I'm not sure exactly what a media watch would look like or how things would begin to be called out. But we also have a pretty defanged FCC that lets Laura Ingraham batter people racially and gender-wise on primetime TV, and there are no consequences.
And a phrase that comes to mind is that we are all in this together. And we know from our embodied experience and our daily lives that we are all connected, and what affects one of us affects all of us. And this is a whole new rethinking. It's not new. It's going back to at least what may be a romanticized idea of our having social bonds that are inextricable and that have enormous effects, roots and cause across the life course. Our youth are invaluable. They're absolutely invaluable. Our babies.
Yeah. So as a final question, what, if anything, are you working on now? And I'm sure you have lots to talk about beyond just maybe another book. I'm sure you seem to be on the front line of a lot of activism and organizing. So can you tell us a bit about that?
No question. We're very much into the project on precarity and its effects on every aspect of life. And we've got many papers in process on critical public health and critical theory and emancipatory gerontology going forward. But we're all about emancipatory gerontology.
One thing that Carol's
also has got a project.
Yeah. One thing that Carol's really shared with me is the importance of mentorship and bringing new people into the field. So I think we're always looking ways to expand our collective. I'm actually about to relocate to New York, where I did my master's program. And I'm excited to bring some of the emancipatory gerontology movement to colleagues that I know are ready and interested. I'm also working on a book now that's bringing in psychoanalytic theory into gerontological study, looking more about what people shy away from, what's disavowed, and how gaining a deeper understanding of how social structures and psychic process are related can help us in our activism, especially as it comes to abolition movements and reckoning with the importance of asylum and having spaces where people feel safe enough to develop themselves.
Yeah, that all sounds absolutely fascinating. So this has been a wonderful hour. Carol Estes and Nicholas DiCarlo, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you for this opportunity.